I've learned that there is one constant. At nearly every event, there is a Ron or a Rhonda. Ron is the person who will raise his hand at the first call for questions or race up to the Q&A mic. He is in the audience, but you get the feeling he would rather be on stage. Ron has decided, either consciously or unconsciously, to see if the workshop should be about him. Ron is often male, but not always. Often white, but not always. He may as well be there to test you, to tempt you. One night, Ron may have prepared a monologue with no question in sight about a recent conversation he had with a second cousin about the American toad, which he thinks the whole audience will find interesting. Another evening, Ron leads with a joke about woke culture, but don't get mad, it's just a joke. And he does have a question. What about him? He grew up poor and white. Does he really have white privilege? On a different day, Ron might chime in to inform an auditorium of people that we don't say auditorium anymore because it is ableist. Ron has determined it's problematic. He has made a habit of manufacturing offense. Ron is the person you want to call out badly. He is minor conflict and distraction embodied. He is just asking questions, countering every point with what about so and so, invoking the oppression Olympics and playing it all off as just a joke. Ron exists in person and online. He can find you at the workplace water cooler, plop down across from you at Thanksgiving dinner, or materialize in your DMs. Sometimes he is a troll goading you to snap at him. More often, he's some combination of confused and overconfident, insecure and misinformed, genuinely curious and well-meaning. As neuropsychology professor Robert Hanlon said, never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity. But one thing's for sure, Ron's comments are well off the mark. Hi, I'm Zahn Valines, and this is the Liberating Motherhood podcast. Today, we are going to be talking about building movement solidarity, calling out versus calling in, and how we can build consensus across distance. I am so excited to be here today with my incredible guest, Loretta J. Ross, who is the author of the vignette I just read. Loretta J. Ross is an activist, professor, and public intellectual. In her 5 decades in the human rights movement, she's deprogrammed white supremacists, taught convicted rapists the principles of feminism, and as national co-director, organized the second largest march on Washington in April 25th, 2004, March for Women's Lives in Washington, D.C., surpassed in size only by the 2017 Women's March. A co-founder of the National Center for Human Rights Education and the Sister Song Women of Color Reproductive Justice Collective, her many accolades and honors include a 2022 MacArthur Fellowship and a 2024 induction into the National Women's Hall of Fame. Today, Ross is an associate professor at Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, and is the founder of LaRasta Consulting, in with which she runs call-in training sessions online and for organizations around the country. She has co-authored many books about reproductive justice. She is also the author of Calling In: How to Start Making Change with Those You'd Rather Cancel, which is the book we will be discussing today. Loretta is a rape survivor, forced to raise a child born of incest, and also a survivor of sterilization abuse at age 23. She is a model of how to survive and thrive despite the traumas that disproportionately affect low-income women of color. Loretta is a mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother. Hi, Loretta. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
And thanks for having me on your show.
I'm so excited to have you here. I told listeners that you would be coming on, and I was inundated with questions for you. So we're just so grateful to have you here and to benefit from your wisdom.
Oh, you're so kind. Let's get started.
All right. So let's just get started with what is toxic call-out culture, and what does it mean to call someone in as an alternative?
Toxic call-out culture is when you want to hold somebody accountable for harm that you think they've done, and you choose a strategy of shaming and blaming them, usually publicly, because that's one of the things that contributes to making it toxic, because you're virtue signaling how woke you are. But really, it's so punitive. It is designed to make somebody feel bad about who they are or what they said or what they believe. And it doesn't really offer any opportunity for the person to grow or change. And it really calls into question whether you wanted the person to grow and change, or did you just want it to perform how you could make somebody feel insignificant and small for what you perceive as a mistake.
That's such a good way of putting it. So one of the things that you and I were talking about a little bit before we started recording is how people have responded to your book and how some people perceive it as just like a manual for being nice to people who are doing harm. I wonder if you would address that just a little bit, because I do think that that's a way that people get defensive about the idea that they have to change their behavior.
I'm not surprised that people think it's a book about being nice and civil to people. That is a superficial interpretation of what I hope is a deeper message. Because if you really want a person to be held accountable for their harm, you have to let go of some assumptions that you make. First, did they actually intend to harm you? Do they even know that they harmed you? Is this something you noticed, but they didn't? Do you assume that they can't make a change or don't want to change, but you won't know until you give them an opportunity to change? And so that trio of assumptions leads to nursing those hurt feelings very close to your heart and then lashing out at the person you say caused you to feel those hurt feelings. And I call it wrapping that mantle of victimhood so concretely around yourself that nothing else penetrates. And then you outsource responsibility for fixing it to the other person. And that rarely works. So it is the most self-defeating strategy of accountability that I can imagine.
Yeah, it really is. So, something that I've been working on recently in my own work is every year I get the same question from people who read my writing, and it is, what are some good New Year's resolutions for activists and feminists? And I always just sort of laugh because something about that's very funny to me. But this year I decided that, okay, I'm going to take seriously this idea of like, how can we be better activists in the new year? So I put together this series that was encouraging people to reflect on their own role in supremacy culture and how that they how they could shift that. And you know, it's these are just my ideas. I'm not the expert on how to be a better person or anything. But what I found really interesting is that every time I would send out one of these reflections, encouraging people to think about things like, you know, what are my biases or where are the areas where I have trauma that makes me mean? The responses that people would give me were always about what they had seen other people do wrong. It was very rare for a person to actually look at themselves and say, well, you know, I tend to get toxic in this situation. And it's just really shown me how hard it is for people to look at themselves and say, here's what I'm doing wrong. And I feel like that relates to this toxic call-out culture in some way. What do you think about that?
Well, I find that our patterns for how we make mistakes, how we handle mistakes, is often etched into our childhood. Because when you were a child, and if you made a mistake, and if you were punished and humiliated for making that mistake, that hurt a lot. And you weren't taught self-forgiveness. Instead, you were shamed and blamed, and weren't even taught what lesson you could learn from that mistake. On the other hand, if you were assured of being loved despite making that mistake and shown that you could do better, you learn self-forgiveness, and you also learn that mistakes aren't fatal. And so as adults, we have the option of deciding whether we're going to continue those toxic patterns of our childhood of lacking self-forgiveness, making us unable to forgive others, punishing and humiliating others so that we live out that truism that hurt people, or are we going to make a different choice and decide that we can call ourselves in, we can forgive ourselves for not being perfect, and we can stop walking around with the expectation that we can only be in right relationships with people who are perfect?
That perfectionism, the idea, it's not even, well, I mean, it is that people have to be perfect, but it's also that they have to agree with us about everything. I mean, I find myself falling into this all the time. It's very hard not to fall into it. I'm wondering if you would give a few examples or even just one example of how we can work across disagreements, how we can work across imperfections or even extreme disagreements, because you have a lot of them in the book, and they've really helped me think through what it really means to build like meaningful solidarity.
Well, one answer has caused me to deeply think about what we mean by diversity. Of course, there's racial, class, gender, citizenship, ability, gender identity diversities. But I think the diversity that we should pay more attention to is experiential diversity, because every human being has been through something different in life. And those differences cause them to think differently about a lot of things. And it is our inability to accept that other people have life patterns and life experiences that aren't yours that make us have unrealistic expectations of how much people should agree with us, how much we're right and they're wrong, how we really have not given ourselves a chance to grow, to appreciate the incredible and wonderful diversity of the human experience, and grow our stamina, resilience, and capacity to take all of that wonderful diversity in. And then appreciate that every human being generally is a combination of good stuff and bad stuff, and you're a combination of good stuff and bad stuff. And I like to think of calling in as focusing on bringing out more of the good in people versus focusing on what's bad about them. I think Adrienne Marie Brown says it so beautifully. What you pay attention to grows. And if you pay attention to the good people are capable of, that's what's going to grow. But if you pay attention only to what they're doing wrong, that's probably what's going to grow too. And so I like to think that we can develop what I call the four intelligences more, our capacity for emotional intelligence and understanding how we react to situations and what our emotions are, our understanding of cultural intelligence, that what we've been through and the life we've lived is not the center of the universe. Other people have come from other cultures and other experiences that are just as valuable as yours. And relational intelligence is learning to right size your expectations of each other so that you don't walk around constantly disappointing yourself by having unrealistic expectations of the people in your life or that you encounter. But I think the fourth intelligence is the one my book most focuses on, and that's integrity intelligence. Constantly striving to make decisions that you can be proud of, that reflect who you are really inside versus the patterns that life and society kind of box you into. And I always want to be able to make decisions that I can look in the eye without shame, not take advantage of the cashier giving me too much change back, but choosing every time to do the right thing because of who I am, not because of who that cashier is. I want to always increase my integrity intelligence.
Really, I love this idea of integrity, intelligence, and I have kind of a maybe on point story to tell you about that. So a few weeks ago, I took my kids to the bookstore, and we love going to the bookstore, and we usually have really good conversations with the people working there, and I'm really trying to teach them to be respectful to everybody they encounter. And we got up to the counter to check out, and the woman who was working at the counter was just being so rude, not just to me, but also to my kids. And at first I tried to be nice, and it just like it wasn't working. And I could feel that frustration bubbling up in me. And so I bent down to get something for my daughter, and my daughter pulled me down and she whispered into my ear, "Mommy, she has dreams too." And it was just like for an 8-year-old, such a profound way to observe her humanity. And I feel like that's something that is often missing when we have disagreements, is that childlike ability to see like, oh, they have dreams too. They have a life as big as mine, even if I don't like them.
That's often an observation we fail to make about others. When we encounter them for that brief moment, we're only getting a snapshot of what's really going on in their lives. And so when I encounter a difficult person, I'm not going to assume that that's the only way they know how to show up, or that that is something they're doing particularly to me. I tend to stop and give them the benefit of the doubt, because we've all had bad days. We've all had people who are so unhappy, they just spread unhappiness like a miasma around them. Or you just don't know what's going on. If I care enough and I have the time, I'll stop and ask a question at something like, "Oh, it looks like you're not having the best of days. Do you have time to tell me a little more? Well, what's going on with you? Because I can feel your pain right now. And I'd like to know more about it so that we can talk a minute." That's a disarming question. And very few people resist the invitation when you say, "Can you just tell me more about what's going on with you?" And that changes the whole toxic atmosphere almost immediately.
That really does. I'm gonna write that one down and try it and may report back to you. So when we're doing movement work, particularly when we're working in groups in like nonprofit settings or direct action settings or that sort of thing, I think we've all had the experience of feeling like the group is getting swept up in this like toxic call-out culture. And sometimes you can recognize it and you can feel like this isn't right. Sometimes you're the one leading it. But when it's the former and you can feel your group just bubbling toward this sort of like vengeance-seeking mean-spiritedness that does not work toward building coalitions, what can you do to kind of slow that down? Have you found ways to, when your own group is behaving that way, not just yourself, but get others to kind of pause and reflect?
In my book, I wrote about advance accountability and advance understanding. If it's a group that I'm involved with over a long term, I try to have a help us have conversations about advance understanding, because most of the people who are drawn to human rights work have experienced some form of trauma that draws them to the movement. And so we have to stop being surprised when that trauma shows up in our organizations and our work. And so that's the difference between being trauma-driven and trauma-informed. And so with advanced understanding, we pull out how that trauma is around us. We're not individualizing it and accusing people of being toxic or performative or any of those kind of things. We're just saying, "This is what we're dealing with. Let's look at this scientifically, logically, dispassionately, so that we are not surprised when it shows up, and we have a strategy in advance for when it does. Now, sometimes, even with all of that, the group agreements and all the conversation you have in preparation of encountering the trauma is still going to show up. So that's what advanced accountability looks like. Okay, if this person insists on, dominating the conversation with their trauma and derailing our group or our discussion, what are we going to do to help that person remain part of the group, but not have such a traumatic impact on the group? And those are things and suggestions that I make in my book. For sometimes you've just come in after the S has already hit the fan. And so that's what advanced accountability is. It allows you to not overreact, not assume that what the person is giving off is yours to take in, but that's where they are and who they are in that moment, and that you are going to hold back your own trauma response so that you can build a container that holds everybody in love and respect, even if you don't feel like it at the time. I think it's like riding a bicycle. When you first try it, you're not going to be good at it. You're going to fall off a couple of times. But if you keep it as your North Star, this is the person I want to show up and be. With practice, you become better at it. And you stop overreacting to displays of trauma, and you anticipate it and plan for it and still enfold the people who manifest it, because everybody's hurt hurts. And so you don't want to dismiss the pain. You just don't want to make let that pain derail people being effective together.
So one of the things that I really love about your book is that you don't just talk in broad aspirational principles about we need to call in, or we need to show respect, or we need to show love and all of that. You tell us how to do a call in. You give us some principles and some examples of how to do it. Can you talk about your principles for an effective call in?
Well, if you notice in my book, I tried to write about every mistake that I'd made from which I had something to learn. So it's not a book about my successes. It's actually a book about many of my mistakes, which made it feel very vulnerable to write and publish. But what I've learned is that when my trauma is triggered, I tend to blurt out whatever's on top for me in that moment. And quite often, I regret that thing that comes out. I'm not proud of it. I am so quick to go nuclear when my trauma is stimulated. And so I've learned that the first step is to put myself on pause, because that first response is going to be my traumatic response. And my second response is going to be my intelligence and integrity response. And by the way, it sounds deep and all of that, but if you've ever parented a child, you do it automatically. Because if you blurt out the first thing that occurs to you when your child is being difficult or stupid, they'll be in therapy for life. So we know to put ourselves on pause, count a few moments, and think about what response we want to give to that child. And so that's the importance of that pause. So, and you use it when you work with a toxic boss, for example. You can't just say the first thing you want to say to that boss unless you want to get fired. Or, you can't say the first thing you want to say to that neighbor unless you want to live next door to a miserable neighbor all the time. So we know how to put ourselves on pause. I just want us to universalize it more. Then you have the second step is to do that internal assessment. Take your own internal temperature. See if you have the bandwidth to even proceed any further with the conversation. Because if you're still feeling raw, if you're still what I call bleeding from your own trauma, then all you're going to do is bleed all over the other person, whether you call them in or out. It doesn't matter. And when people are called in or out, they actually feel the same way about it. They feel embarrassed, like a spotlight has been put on them. So after you've taken that internal assessment, that's when you choose from what I call my 5C continuum. You can call them out, you can cancel them, you can call them in, or you can call on them to do better, or you can call it off and disengage. You have all of those choices. And so that's the third step. Make the choice from that 5C continuum that makes sense for you in that moment, because you have no obligation to call people in or out. Your first obligation should be to see to your own healing. But once, while you're doing that, you can decide whether you have space to offer grace and respect to someone else at the same time.
So when you mentioned kids, I was laughing because my child has been lucky to have a teacher actually for several years now who is a 50-year teaching veteran. And I just adore and admire her. And I've learned a lot about parenting and teaching from her. And she has this thing that she says to kids when they're acting a fool. And she says, "What is your plan?" in this very gentle, kind voice. And one day I asked her, like, how did you get to this point where you could be so patient with children who are acting, like feral monsters? And she looked at me, and this is just this very kind, gentle, sweet old lady who I've never heard use any profanity or anything. And she said, "I just decided one day that what the fuck kind of bullshit are you getting up to? I could just communicate by instead saying, what's your plan?" And it's just, I don't know, it seems like the child version of calling in. So that's why I was laughing at that.
It is, because a lot of people aren't aware of how they are projecting their inner chaos onto others. And with gentle questions, you can help them become more self-examining without accusing them of things. Again, that's what I call offering them a chance to grow. Now, it's some people actually do want to be jerks. And that's when I say, just own it. Don't act like you're an accidental jerk. But if you're not planning on being a jerk, do you mind if we discuss how you can say what you mean what you say, and then making a choice about not saying it mean?
I really like that. The accidental jerk thing, that's definitely a thing. I wanted to go back because you talked about sort of the book being about your failures and the vulnerability of sharing that. And I just wanted to share with you that I came to your book as a longtime follower of your work, and to someone who doesn't know you, who just reads your work and reads about your successes, it's very easy to feel like, oh, this person is just really good at everything. This person just knows how to do everything right. And so seeing where you maybe have not done things right or where you've reflected on that is really powerful, I think, to most people because, I mess up constantly when I'm trying to do the right thing. And to just know that someone else is struggling with those same things and able to use those failures as an opportunity for growth, I think is so important for us all to consider.
I think everybody's messing up to some degree or another. I don't know anybody's perfect. I mean, it's alleged that Jesus was, but he's already got that job, so I don't want his job. And if you can give yourself the relational intelligence to understand that we're just crappy people with crappy skills trying to make the best of a crappy situation. You really can practice self-forgiveness as well as forgiveness of others and give people the room to grow. The room to grow phrase that I use repeatedly was one that I came to after my boss, Reverend C.T. Vivian, told me that I needed to help deprogram white supremacists when I was doing opposition research against the Ku Klux Klan and the neo-Nazi movements and stuff. And Reverend Vivian used to often say that when you ask people to give up hate, then you have to be there for them when they do. And when he first told me that, I was like, oh, hell no. That does not work for me. If you hate me, I'm going to hate you back, kind of thing. I'm going to give off the same energy that you're giving me, as we would say now. But I'm so glad Reverend Vivian told me that, because it forced me to, first of all, and I was willing to commit to not giving off that hate anymore, even though in my heart I felt they deserved it. But the question quickly became, but am I the person who's doing the best I can do to become the best person I can be if I'm walking around giving off hate? The thing that people misunderstand about calling in is that it's not what you do for others, it's what you do for yourself. Is how you are constantly showcasing your ability to grow, your ability to offer love and respect. I find it interesting that so many of our iconic ancestors, like Audre Lorde and bell hooks and James Baldwin and Dr. King, get quoted so well, but they're rarely actually believed by activists. Because every one of those people talked about meeting hate with love. And nobody wants to quote that part of their lives. I find that interesting.
It's hard. It's really hard. And I know
It's harder to just be in a pool of hate all the time, too.
I think there's this dynamic, and I think it's been amplified by social media, where we think if something feels good, it is good. So like, it feels good to yell at the person who's wrong. It feels good to hold ourselves up as the paragons of moral virtue, even as we know we aren't. And that to me, I think that's the thing that people can get really addicted to, is it feels so good to tell people how wrong they are.
I don't find that as a sustainable joy.
No, definitely
It's
not.
kind of like cheating at solitaire.
Yeah.
Yeah, you won the game, but you also know secretly that you cheated. And so you're going around telling everybody else off when you secretly know that you're not perfect either.
Well, and you also lose the game long term, because if
Right.
the purpose is to improve the world, you're alienating people. It's that trauma piece that you talk about, and I think that's been really important for me in my activism, to realize that the places and the ways in which I am most likely to behave badly are in spaces of trauma. And just, I think that insight is so important.
Well, the Centers for Disease Control scientifically validates that 64% of the adult American public has experienced what they call ACEs, adverse childhood experiences. And that means violence, abuse, or neglect. That's two-thirds of the adult public. And all of that violence, abuse, and neglect happened before they were 18 years old. So two-thirds of everybody you encounter in every setting are walking bundles of trauma. And very, very few have sought professional healing for it. And so doing worse, like, using drugs or alcohol or other kinds of forms of self-abuse. But once you understand that this isn't personal, this is structural, and this is social trauma, and then on top of all that personal trauma we went through, look what's happening in the world. So that compounds all the personal trauma that we're all having to manage. And so once you see the structural and the social nature of it, For me, it de-individualizes it. And it makes me less likely to want to see the person as blamed, to be blamed and just that they're dysfunctional, and just see them as a victimized violator who first got victimized and think that part of their healing is to violate others in a very self-righteous way.
All right, so we're talking about calling in other people and how we can more productively do that. But also, pretty much all of us, especially if we have people around us who we can trust, are also going to be called in from time to time. And I want to talk a little bit about sort of defensiveness and those sorts of impulses because, feedback is a gift, but it sure doesn't feel like a gift. It can be really hard to receive even a really loving call in. What do you advise people to do to slow down our own reactivity so that we can listen with open minds to the feedback that those around us offer?
I find people can learn things pretty easily if you present it as a formula. So I have a 1, 2, 3 formula for when you're called out. Number one, it's going to sound counterintuitive, but you can actually thank the person for calling you out. Why am I doing that? They just embarrassed me. They just humiliated me. They told me I was wrong. Slow down. Take the pause. What they gifted you with, whether you appreciate it or not, is time and attention. They assured you of your significance, because if they thought you were unimportant, they wouldn't have bothered. They obviously think you're important, and they gave you something that the social media companies are spending millions to get: time and attention. So you can sincerely thank them as step one. The thing that the person who called you out probably most sincerely needs is assurance that you've heard them, that you think they're significant as well. So you can say, "Thank you for bringing that to my attention. I'm going to consider what you've said." You've assured them that you heard them, but what you have not done is agree with them yet, because you don't know if they're right or wrong. You haven't had time to think about it. You're caught off guard because they just called you out. So you can say thank you, and you can tell them that you heard them, but you can also take your own sweet time to decide whether they're right or not. And then the third step is to turn the calling out into a calling in. And with that, I'll say something like, "Thank you. I'll consider what you said, but since I care as much about you as I do myself in this relationship, I want to know if you're okay, because I'm pretty sure you could have gotten my attention in another way. So what's going on with you? Are you feeling unheard? Are you feeling hurt? And can we have a conversation about that?" So you acknowledge their significance. You've gotten them to acknowledge yours. You've acknowledged that you're going to consider what they've said, and you told them that you're willing to have further conversation about what the next steps are. So that diffuses a whole lot right there. You haven't admitted guilt. You haven't dismissed them as being beneath your notice. You haven't escalated it into a defensive, "No, I'm not. I didn't do that. Na-na-na-na-na." You treated them with the human respect you want others to treat you. And it works so beautifully. I see this work over and over again. I'll tell you another example. I teach calling in techniques online, and usually in a Zoom room to 300 people. And this one participant is a blind woman who said that every time she has to walk through a door, step up a step, this arm comes out of nowhere and just places it on her body. And because she's a sexual assault survivor, she said, "I always react violently to that because I can't see it coming. Somebody's putting their arms on me and I don't know what's going on." And She said, but I don't like reacting that way. What can I do, Loretta? And so I asked her to reframe what she was experiencing as an attempt at kindness done badly. And so here's one, two, three again. One, thank them for their attempt at being kind, because you want more kindness. You don't want people to say, I'm never going to help another blind person again because of the way this person reacted. No, that's not what you actually want. You want more kindness. Step two, set your boundary. Just like before, you can say something like, you know, I really appreciate your trying to help me, but I really don't like strangers putting their hands on me because, as you can see, I can't see it coming. So I don't know how to interpret that. Third step, but call them in. If in the future you want to help a blind person, do you mind if we stop and talk a little bit about what would be appropriate? One, two, three. You thank them for their kindness. You set your boundary and you've turned the calling out that you would have offered into a calling in.
I love that. I love that formula. And so shortly before I got on Zoom with you, I just happened to watch this video on social media that I've been reflecting on, and it's a young Latino ICE officer at a protest, and he's not displaying the kind of aggression that you see from a lot of these ICE officers. He's kind of hanging back. And there's a young Latino protester talking to him and pushing on him and saying, he's calling him brother, and he's saying, do you like this job? Does this make you feel good about yourself? You're a smart guy. I know there are other things you can do. I can see that there's compassion in your eyes. And I watched this video, and I think before I watched the video, I would have said, these ICE people are beyond redemption and there's nothing we can do. But it was really masterful. And, I would love to see what happens next or if that officer is thinking about anything. And so that's sort of the context in which I ask you this question, which is we're seeing these ICE horrors right now. And I'm seeing, such incredible solidarity. But what I'm also seeing is two conflicting messages about how we bring more people in. And one is that, there are Trump voters who are starting to regret their choices. And there are even ICE officers who are starting to regret their choices and that we should, try to pull them in. And then the counter message is that, well, these people only care now that there are white people getting hurt or these people are untrustworthy. And this, to me, this kind of dynamic strikes me as a dynamic where your ideas about calling in are really helpful. So I wonder if you would just reflect on that a little bit with me and tell me your thoughts.
I've thought deeply about applying calling in to the situation with the ICE officers in particular. Now I have a totally different strategy for the Trump administration. I'm calling them out as much as I can because I don't think that they are accidentally being malevolent. I think they're doing it on purpose. So I have a different strategy for the puppeteers than I have for the puppets. But when I think about the ICE situation, I think about being a child during the Vietnam War. And I was a candy striper at our local military hospital. And my job was to deliver library books to the soldiers coming back from Vietnam. And these were boys who were only 4 years older than me because I was 14. They were like 18, 19, 20, missing half of their bodies. And at the time, there was a lot of protests against the Vietnam War and the soldiers in it. But I could never see it that way. What I saw were a bunch of children, not much older than me, caught up in an economic draft where they didn't have a lot of economic options. They saw going into the military as a way to get their education or take care of their families or, just pursue their lives. I think we have a similar situation right now. We have a horrible economy where people can't afford to buy food, pay for their housing, pay for their education. So they're getting this offer of what seems like a tremendous amount of money if they just sign up to be in a uniform like those Vietnam soldiers. But this one is even worse because they're being offered like those $50,000 signing bonuses. But that's not true. They're given $10,000 per year. They only get the 50 if they stay for the 5 year enlistment. And if they quit any time before that 5 year is up, they've got to pay back the bonuses. So if you quit after the first year, you got to pay back 10,000. If you quit after the second year, 20, on and on. And so I know that there's a lot of people in the ICE forces who are unabashed racists, the Proud Boys, the Oath Keepers, the January 6th people, people who are not redeemable and not trying to be. They are delighting in the cruelty. The cruelty is their point. But I also assume that the majority of the people who sign up for these militarized jobs are people doing it because they're making the best decision they think they can make at the time that they made their decisions. They're being driven by their own pain and suffering, their own economic circumstances. And so it's not popular right now to talk about humanizing ICE people. I know that. Every time I try to have this conversation, most people want to point out the horrors and not the humanity that's behind those badges and those uniforms. So I'm glad you told me that story because it has been hard for me to even dehumanize the ICE people because I see the larger context in which they're making their decisions and their choices. And I know a lot of them regret the bind that they're in right now. Because what sounded like an enticing offer to go arrest illegal criminals turned out to not be exactly or even closely what they're being ordered to do. And yet they're facing a public who has nothing but disgust for the orders that they've been given and see them as complicit in the cruelty and the venality of those orders. So it's, and of course, I'm never going to lose sight of the victims, you know, the true victims of people losing their lives and getting harmed and the children being kidnapped and shot in the face and you know that kind of thing. Of course, no more than I would lose sight of what happened to the Vietnamese people during the Vietnam War. So I would like those of us who are in the human rights movement to bring a sophisticated analysis to what is going on and not just a us versus them analysis, because that is an oversimplification of what's really taking place. And I would argue that this whole massive assault is not about immigrants to begin with. It's to cover up the Epstein files.
Yes.
And we should never lose sight of that.
Yeah, it's so true. So, one of the things that I've been really trying to hammer with people is that despair is our enemy. Despair is always our enemy because if we despair, then we don't take meaningful action. But it's really hard right now. I think it's always been really hard to not despair. So I wanted to ask you for our last question. How do you maintain a sense of hope in the face of all the horrors that have been going on for so long? And what advice do you have for listeners in this political moment who really want to do good, but who may feel overwhelmed, scared, and perhaps hopeless?
I was very fortunate to have enjoyed the counsel of many great mentors. I became an activist when I was 16 years old at my first year at Howard University. And of course, I was so cocky. I thought I'd do everything and nobody could tell me anything. And I would weaponize each piece of knowledge I learned and accuse others of being too dumb to know what I know. I mean, it was just, you know, this. The insufferableness of being an early activist. And fortunately, the people, the older people in my life, the mentors who had been in the movement for a long time, didn't give up on insufferable me. and they offered me all kinds of sage advice, but I can pull out a few snippets. The first one is a saying from the civil rights movement. Don't let your ego imagine that you're the entire chain of freedom, because the chain of freedom stretches back towards your ancestors and forward towards your descendants. Your only job at this moment is to not let the chain break at your link. Make sure you don't break that chain or make it brittle through your apathy or despair or hopelessness or your sense that nothing can be done, that your efforts are insignificant, because they are important, no matter how minor they may seem in the larger scheme of things. And so when people come at me with this cynicism that there's nothing we can do or nothing will matter, nothing can be effective, I remind them of the chain of freedom, that you don't have to, take responsibility for the past or the future, but you do have to take responsibility for having the privilege of seeing your link and choosing whether you're going to nurture that link and protect it, or you're going to break it because you're smarter than all the ancestors and all the descendants. So that's the first thing. Now, I used to also walk, go through life looking at all the horrors that people do to each other, because when you monitor hate groups, you're going to see a lot of the consequences of hate. People dying, people traumatized, whole communities terrorized and stuff. And one of my mentors, Leonard Zeskin, saw me in a real depression and sense of despair after a five-year-old black child had perished in a fire because the fire department was being run by a man in the Ku Klux Klan, and he called black homes burning neighborhood beautification. And so he intentionally delayed fire trucks coming to black f fires in black homes. And Lenny told me to lighten up. Lenny said, "Loretta, you need to learn that fighting Nazis can be fun. It's being a Nazi that sucks." And he made me laugh involuntarily because he gave me perspective. Fighting for truth and justice and human decency is a joy. It's a privilege. The people who are fighting against happiness and joy and decency, they're the ones having a miserable life, because they're, you have to imagine how tortured that soul has to be to despise empathy, to despise compassion, to despise neighborliness like we're seeing in Minnesota. So that was also some sage advice. And then the one that I just laugh every time I have to say it. The reason I've been able to do this work for well over 50 years is someone once told me, "Loretta, you need to party as hard as you work." And it's not hard to tell a teenager to party, but I didn't know that it was part of a resilience strategy. So I have a toggle switch to my consciousness. I can turn it on when I need to be woke and pay close attention to the news and the newspaper, show up at the demonstration, write that paper or that post on Twitter or whatever. And then I can turn it off and just watch, HGTV mindlessly, with no shame, with no regret, with no guilt. Because sustainability means preparing for the long haul, not just for the here and now.
I think that's great advice, and I think that's a great note to end this on. Loretta, thank you so much for coming on. I can't tell you how excited I am that I got to talk to you. I'm so grateful for your work, and knowing that you are out there in the world really inspires me to do and be better. So thank you. Listeners,
Thank
I will
you.
put all of Loretta's information and books in the show notes, as well as on the Liberating Motherhood Bookshop reading list. I really hope you'll explore Call Again and all of Loretta's amazing work. As always, thanks for being here, And again, thank you, Loretta.
Thank you again.